This is Wildlife by the Numbers, a podcast about wildlife ecology focused on the proper and robust design of studies concerned with the conservation and management of fish and wildlife. We hope to entertain and enlighten young and aspiring wildlife ecologists, along with seasoned professionals. Our wish is to help guide the application of science in conservation. I am Grant Harris, and today we have
Matt Butler
and David Stewart.
All right, we're all here. Today we're going to talk about how precise a project result should be. So when you're doing a project, how precise should you have your results? And we have an easy answer for that. And I guess we'll do a spoiler alert. The easy answer is it really depends on the project you're doing and how you're going to use that information to influence what you do or explain what's going on in the system. But before we get to why we feel that way, let's talk about what precision is, and even prior to that, what is variability and what is accuracy. We have gotten into some of this in our prior podcast, but we've never really kind of dove into this topic more explicitly as far as what is variability in data, what do we want to see, and what is accuracy of data, and how precise do we want to have project results be. Before we get into variability and precision, just as far as importance on this, in the wildlife sciences arena, we're all collecting data to investigate and understand some sort of biological or other natural process. And as I've said, we've already spoken about sampling and number of samplings in the past, and now we're speaking to how meaningful our results are, which gets at precision. I guess before we start talking about variability and accuracy and precision, any comments, Matt or Randy, before we dive in on this?
I just thought it was funny that you gave us the classic answer that always works, right? It depends. We just have to get into why does it depend?
Yeah, well said. All right. Let's talk about variability. And before I attempt to give it a definition, Randy or Matt, do you want to describe when we talk about variability and what we mean by variability?
Yeah, just basically describes how spread out the data points are within the data set. But in the context of wildlife surveys, can represent the differences in counts across different locations. So you have variation in time, variation in space. And that's a function of animal behavior, natural fluctuations in populations.
And we're talking about space. We're talking about geographical space, not like asteroids and black holes and things. We're saying, you know, what's it in like a given plot or a given landscape?
Exactly.
There's different measures of variability that we know about that we commonly see. We'll speak about them before we get into like accuracy and precision. So some of the common ones we'll see are range, quartiles or interquartile range, standard deviations, variance, and coefficient of variation. Randy, you want to speak to any of these? How about maybe we start with range and quartiles? What thoughts on that? Utility, what it actually means?
Yeah, the range is just the difference between the maximum or value and the lowest value. And it's pretty influenced by extreme values. So it's not a reliable measure of variability.
So I mean, sometimes when I look at data sets, I'll like look at, like I'm checking data for errors and stuff. I'll look at the range. I'll look at the max and min. And I think that's kind of what you're speaking to is like if you are doing something like the weight of cats and all of a sudden you get something that says 200 house cats and you get something that says 200 pounds as a max, you know that there's some sort of data error in your set that you want to figure out what that is before you start analyzing it.
Right. Exactly. I mean, it's just the most basic measure of variability.
Right on. How about quartiles?
Yeah, that one is the range between the 25th and the 75th percentiles of the data. It is less affected by outliers in comparison to range. It typically allows you to understand like the central tendencies of the parameter of interest or the measurement of interest.
So some folks on that are listening may be familiar with a thing called a box plot, right? And that's kind of gets at your quartiles where you get the middle of your box plot is your mean. And then your upper box can be your 75th quartile, and then the lower box edge could be the 25th percent quartile. And then in that, you might get like a string of dots that shows your values below or above the quartile range. And then again, that gets idea of your spread and how aggregated your variables are. It could be also a way to look for outliers in information. But that's always good to do before you start analyzing data to see, okay, does this look sensible, or do I have values in here that are just nonsensical that I need to look at and make sure that they're right or remove because there's some transcription error? Matt, how often do you do that stuff? Like when you screen data, are you using ranges and quartiles? Or do you have other methods that you use?
Probably all the time. I think one thing that jumped out at me, what Randy said, was that range doesn't really necessarily tell you a lot, or isn't necessarily a good measure of your overall variability. And I think that's true because you can, you know, just think about your house cats, right? Your house cats are what, on average, maybe 2 or 3 pounds. But I've seen what appear to be 20-pound house cats, right? Those are quite unusual and outside the norm. And so your range is going to be from, like, I don't know, if we're just talking about adult house cats, a pound and a half all the way to, say, 25 pounds. Those 25-pounders are not the norm. That's not something that really tells you a lot about how variable your population really is. I mean, the vast majority of your house cats are somewhere around 2 or 3 pound range, probably. And so one way to try to get past that is to do the interquartile range or something like that. That helps. But yeah, I find these measures more useful, like you said, Grant, for the finding those weird outliers, which may be cool, interesting outliers that we want to look into. Like, we've got a plot that we're getting 12 black rails calling at. Well, but most plots have 2. Is that an anomaly? And if it, or an error? If it's an error, well, then we want to get rid of that. But if it's an anomaly, in other words, it's real, but it's just odd, what is it about that plot that's so special? You know, hey, what's going on with this spot? Why are there so many black rail over here? And it might reveal something really interesting about what's good habitat for that species or what's good conditions for that species. So yeah, those outliers, those weird points can be super useful, super interesting, but they can also be problematic. And so you don't just necessarily throw one away just because, oh, that's odd. It's twice or 3 times larger than anything else I got. Let's spend some time investigating it, checking it out, talking to the folks who collected the data.
In my experience, those are pretty good measures to identify typos. So if you have like a variable that typically is 35.5 and you're starting to see them at 355, you realize when you're receiving a new data set like Matt and I typically do to help answer questions on behalf of our partners and cooperators, we start realizing that they may be contributed to data entry errors.
I don't know, you guys, every house cat I've had, I think, has been pushing 10 pounds. I don't know what my kids feed them. It must be hot dogs and tuna fish cans, but they really put it on. So
Grant, I haven't had a house cat since I lived with my parents. So I don't remember their weights.
No, it's funny. All right. First, so a little bit more here on variability. So let's talk about standard deviation and variance. Who wants to cover that one?
I'll take standard deviation. Standard deviation indicates the average deviation of an individual data point from the mean. And that's essentially the equation that you're using. And it provides insights into the overall spread and consistency of the results. Or measurements that you're seeking to collect.
So it's say you have a mean value of 20 and you have a data point that's 22. You know, so you're taking the value of 2 in that case. And then you have another one that might be 25 and you're taking the value of 5 in that case. And you're using those values to quantify your standard deviation or your spread around that mean, like you're saying, Randy.
Exactly. And to add to that, the variance is simply the square of the standard deviation. So when you're doing that difference of 22 minus the mean of 20, which I believe those are the values you used, you're taking the square of those individual measurements in comparison to the mean, which is pretty useful for describing the variability. Let's say if you're wanting to do counts as the metric of choice, so you're looking at like a variability of counts across different, like in your study area or through time. That'd be a way to do it.
And is it valid? I'm kind of going from memory here in a kind of, if one data in one standard deviation is 60% of your values, and then in 2 standard deviations, around 95 or 98% of your values, something along those lines. And so, if you look at, so typically we look at values in one standard deviation. So the bigger that number around your mean, right? So you have a mean of 20 and a standard deviation of 10. That means 65% of your values are within 10 units of your mean. How about CV? That's one we often use.
It's the ratio of the standard deviation to the mean. It's expressed as a percentage, and it's the relative measure of variability, useful for comparing variability across species, populations, years, or even survey methods.
And that's, and typically in wildlife surveys, like the standard for us would be a 20% coefficient of variation. That's CV. It stands for coefficient of variation. We're usually looking for 20%. We try to get better than that, but if you can get 20%, you're doing pretty good.
Yeah, there's this arbitrary cutoffs that people have established. Some people look at CVs of 25%, 25% for management-based surveys, and anything less than 20% are for more research-based surveys. Those are not really defined other than just being simply arbitrary measures given realistic survey effort. And that's a function of time, personnel, and obviously monies.
Right on. All right. How about we get into accuracy and precision? Do you want to tackle this one or should we kick it to Randy again?
We can kick it to Randy. He's doing a really good job, but I guess I should say something. In my mind, I like to split accuracy and precision into different things. So to me, accuracy is about bias, if you will. So how well I can hit the target. Precision to me is about how well my darts, if you will, that I throw at the target are grouped. Now others kind of lump those things into one, seems like, where accuracy and precision are really just synonyms of one another. So it just depends on your definition.
Right. I mean, we kind of use them interchangeably and colloquially, but technically they're not. And the classic bullseye example is where you have a target that you're throwing darts at. And if you are getting, you know, your data clumps, your arrows, you say arrows, your darts,
darts,
water balloons, if they're all clustering around the bullseye or in a certain part of the target, they're precise.
Yes.
Right? They're precise. They're all in the same sort of general spot. They may not be accurate because accurate would be in this case that bullseye, but they are precise. They are in a one spot. Now, they are also kind of invariant because they're all in the same sort of spot. And so these terms, you know, you can kind of get wrapped up around them. But what I would say is, you know, variability, speaking about data, it's like how variable are your base line collected data. When you get to precision, you're talking about, okay, now I've done statistics on these data. How precise is my estimate? How much variability is in my estimate or my result? And then accuracy is it actually reflecting truth? Is it actually telling us something about the underlying value that's really out there in the world that we're measuring? So in our case, say the actual mean value of all cats in the world is 5 pounds. And we're getting a mean value of 5.5, we could say, hey, we're pretty accurate. If we're getting a mean value of, you know, 20 or 2, we're low. And it's not going to be an accurate result. So that's kind of where these all kind of interchange together. We got a couple more definitions of precision here. Then we'll kind of get into how precise do we want estimates to be. So we'll actually get to the root of the question. Other estimates of precision, we're talking about standard errors and confidence intervals. Matt, would you mind covering standard errors?
I think the way I would describe it is it describes precision. Now, variation tells us whether we're estimating variation or we actually truly know it about a population. It tells us how much spread there is in a population. But now when we start talking about things like standard error, we are trying to understand how well we've done at estimating some parameter of that population, say the mean. And so that is a function of our sample size. And so the standard error is just simply the standard deviation, how much sample variation we see in our data set divided by the square root of the sample size. So it's basically scaled by your sample size. So the more samples you have, the more precise your estimate's going to be.
Yeah, that's right.
There still may be a huge amount of variation in your population, right? But because I've sampled that population sufficiently, I can say I have pretty good certainty in, say, my estimate of my mean. Whereas if I only take a few samples, say 10, I'm not going to have a whole lot of certainty in that estimate of the mean.
So confidence intervals, how can we explain that simply for our listeners?
Confidence intervals are just another way of representing a standard error, but it gives us an idea of, say, if we were to go out and repeat what we just did, say 100 times, we would expect the mean to occur in our confidence intervals. Say if we were doing 95% confidence intervals, 95 out of 100 times. So that new mean from each of those new resamples would occur inside that 95% confidence interval. Boy, I almost tripped all over that, but hopefully that makes sense to folks.
Yeah, because we use credibility intervals more now in our Bayesian framework, and that is kind of different. We should make it more clear, confidence interval versus credibility interval. They're used the same way, but they mean different things.
Credibility intervals are based on values from a posterior probability density. And the way they're defined is a little different than the frequentist approach, where Matt was saying, if we replicated the experiment, we should expect this. There it's showing the plausibility of the parameter has in those values, given the confidence intervals regarding that parameter of interest, which is oftentimes the mean or some slope coefficients as part of our regression.
So is it fair to say, in like the most simplistic terms, and maybe overly simplistic, that in keeping what Matt explained, if using a confidence interval and you did an experiment 100 times, your 95% interval is like, okay, I would like to capture the mean within 95% of these trials.
Yes, it's viewing the population parameter, the mean in your case, as fixed, and therefore it's not being interpreted as necessarily an object of a probability.
Right. So if I did 100 trials, my sample size is 30 cats, and I get a mean value, and I do that 100 times, I am likely to capture that mean correctly in 95% of those trials.
Yes, because of the assumption that the parameter is fixed.
Now, the credibility interval is, if I do the experiment once, I'm 95% sure the mean is actually in these values.
Yeah, given your data. So it's incorporating the uncertainty of the mean given the data that you're using.
I think in the end, both are trying to describe something about how certain we are about the estimate we're providing from our experiment. That's how everybody wants to interpret a confidence interval, is that I got a 95% chance that my mean is inside this interval. And
that's not it.
Not actually how you... Yeah. Right. How you interpret a confidence interval, but it is how you interpret a credible interval.
Yeah. All right. So we spoke about variability. We've spoken about accuracy, and we've spoken about precision. And now that you're all thoroughly confused, we will speak about how do we actually use precision in the real world, and how precise do we want to have data be to actually make sure that our experiment has some value and some worth and can help us make influential decisions from that.
Can I correct something there?
Yeah.
I think we assume we measure data correctly. So what we're talking about, how precise do we want estimates from data to be? That's a whole other animal of how precise are your data.
Oh, you're right. Yeah.
If I'm measuring distance, I can measure distance in meters, centimeters, or millimeters. That's different levels of precision.
Yeah.
So.
Good point. We're talking about precision and results.
Yeah. So how precise are our estimates of abundance or a mean value or density or a slope, and say in a regression coefficient, those sorts of things.
Thanks for the correction, Matt. So I began the broadcast kind of giving the short, quick, and dirty answer is it really depends on what you want to know and how you want to use it. Now we're going to kind of get into what we actually mean by that. Randy or Matt, do you want to dive in before I continue?
I think the reason it depends is because it depends on, number one, how important the answer is. Like, what's the average weight of cats? I don't know that I care. Maybe others care, but it's not that important of an answer, so I don't need a super precise answer there, right? Unless I'm studying cats for a specific purpose. Whereas if I want to manage something about a population, it could be cats, and need to make decisions regarding how much I feed them or how much water I provide them or whatever it might be, then yeah, probably need a pretty precise estimate. So it kind of depends on how important your answer is. If it's kind of gee whiz, well, it'd be nice to know, versus, now this is really going to dictate how much money this program costs and how much effort we have to put in, then I probably need something a little more precise. And that gets to the certainty issue. Like, do I need to be really certain that on average house cats are 2.5 pounds or 5 pounds? You know, do I need to have much certainty in that? It depends on what I'm trying to do. But other things, we need lots of certainty. Like, we're going to make a decision about listing or downlisting a species, and we might want a lot of certainty in how many we have of that species and at what rate that population is growing. So it just depends on the context and the circumstances.
You know, when you're speaking about that, Matt, remind me of the work that we've done with whooping cranes, and others have done this too, I think, you know, with sea otters and that nature. But it's common across, I would say, recovery programs in general for threatened and endangered species. So for whooping cranes, I think right now, correct me if I'm wrong, but I think right around, we're bouncing roughly around 550 birds. That's the Aransas wood buffalo flock. We're looking at going from a downlisting from endangered to threatened once we get to 1,000. I believe that's what our criteria is now.
Yeah, that's the current criteria in the, I think it's the 2007 International Recovery Plan.
Okay. And so we're bouncing roughly around 550 birds. From a standpoint of assessing, should the bird be downlisted from endangered to threatened, if that criteria stays at 1,000, we're nowhere close to 1,000 birds. And given its population growth rate, we're a number of years away. So if the only reason we're using an abundance estimate for whooping cranes is to evaluate its threatened criteria, we don't really need a precise answer for that right away. It could be off by like 100 birds, and it's not going to affect our decision. But if we have a population of around 950 birds or 970 birds, then we would like to have an increase in our precision, so we don't want to be off by 25 or 30 birds so that we can make a more informed decision on if we want to downlist it or not. So the amount of precision you have in your estimate, it just depends, again, on what you're going to use that estimate for and how it's going to affect your decision making.
And at the very minimum, it's going to give you the target of how good you're going to be able to describe your results, meaning that if you only have, let's say, funding to pursue samples at like 10 or 20 sites, but to achieve, let's say, a target of detecting the 10% change in the population size of, let's say, whooping cranes, and you're doing 10 or 20 sites. But what's really needed to, in order to achieve a 10% decline, is that you have to do 60 sites, but your funding source is only going to allow you to do 10 or 20. It now allows you to understand, well, one, where can I invest those monies elsewhere? Because it's not going to allow me to say heads or tails anything about the population trajectory of that species. Or two, it's going to tell you at how best you're going to be able to say something about that population. So being able to have like a measurable target associated with at least these survey type objectives that we're speaking to is very important, because that's going to drive the number of samples you need as you try to minimize the sources of variability.
One thing we did for whooping cranes when we were starting to consider, like, well, how precise do we need our survey to be? Because like Grant said, we're pretty far from that prescribed downlisting criteria. As we started thinking about other things that affect the management of the species and what might trigger some sort of management intervention, And so we were doing work on like trying to understand how drought and things like that might cause population declines short term, say hiccups in the population growth of the species. And anyway, through that work, we were able to show like, well, if there was 1 year, 2 year, 3 year type hiccups in growth rate, so maybe even declines, how long would it take for that to recover? And that kind of gave us an idea of how much precision we needed in our estimate. Number one, to be able to detect that, but then number one, to be able to detect it in a quick enough manner to be able to do something about it. Now, I'm being kind of vague about it because the details are kind of hairy and hard to describe, but you start to see the picture of like, well, how much decline is too much decline? And for how long is that decline a big deal? And those are the kinds of things that tell you how much precision you need, because you need to be able to detect those sorts of declines before they happen. And so that gave us an idea then of how much precision we needed in our survey efforts, or in our results from our survey efforts. And then we set up a survey to try to achieve that kind of precision.
How about we end it here for today, and we'll continue this conversation next time on our subsequent podcast. So until then, thank you for listening to Wildlife by the Numbers. We hope you enjoyed it and maybe learned something.